connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web for web.
Computer today.
Computer.
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 NetSurfer Pro.
Hello and welcome to Talk Surfer Show, a whirlwind ride through whatever we want. I am your main host this week, Galen, as is my right, this being Talk Surfer Show and not NetSurfer Pro, a whirlwind ride through the World Wide Web.
And I am your co-host, Matthew Marissa, and let's just go right into it. We've got a trailer blazes here.
Yes.
New trailer for the Mario Bros. Movie, coming soon to theaters this summer.
Cucumber. Ghosts will now appear in your movie theater.
Trailer blazes.
Yeehaw!
Yeah. So, I feel like this didn't really reveal much about the actual storyline. It seems pretty straightforward. There is a Luma, which is pretty fun. Luma's
there's
confirmed.
A Luma.
There's these like three scenes in a row of like landscape shots. The first one is like a fire flower field with like a big, like, I'm assuming a sacred tree in the middle of it. It looks very Lion King. And then
There's
one with a cannon in the foreground and a floating island, and I think that's supposed to be Bob-omb Battlefield.
Okay.
Because there's the Mario 64 cannon and it's pointed at a floating island. And then after that is just Sand Kingdom from Odyssey.
We got more appearances of little guys. Mm-hmm. We got some more repeats of scenes we've already seen, unfortunately. But that's really the thing that I'm looking forward to is scenes with wide shots of a bunch of little guys doing a bunch of stuff is kind of Illumination's specialty.
Mm-hmm.
Like literally kind of their special, literally sort of what put them on the map. And so I'm super excited for just, you know, scenes of a bunch of fucking Koopa Troopas and Goombas doing stuff. The, like you said, not a whole lot of reveals as far as, like, the story. It's basically what we have currently, you know?
We got a longer view of the Rainbow Road scene, and a detail I really liked was that they had the Mario Kart 8 tires, where, like, they go horizontal to become jets. When they're anti-grav mode, and you could see Mario do a little drift. He was charging the mini turbo. What CC do you think they're on in the movie? If it's not 200, I'm boycotting.
Yeah, unfortunately, it kind of seems like it's about 100 based off the. So I did some back of the napkin math based off of, you know, like on frame one, they were this far away, and then frame 10, they were this far away. So you translate that to 1/6 a second. And I think they were probably at 79 cc, which is a really strange number. This might be a reference to 1979 when Illumination was founded by Dave Illumination
for you long time fans. Just a little in joke.
Yep.
Yeah,
it's nothing to do with Mario though, specifically nothing to do with Mario.
Overall, every trailer makes me more interested in the movie in the sense that it makes it feel more like they care about making a good Mario movie.
Yeah.
Like, the addition of Bob-omb Battlefield and in Sand Kingdom are like, yeah, this makes sense. This works. We also finally saw Mario eat a mushroom and grow big.
Yes.
Which was surprising.
He swelled in size.
And
it
then he
glorious.
Does the Mario run, which is also the Naruto run.
Yes.
That's the thing. Everybody calls it the Naruto run, but Mario did the whole hands to the side thing first.
Well, did he do it first?
Mario Bros. 3. Look it up.
Ah, damn. Hang on. Mario Bros. 3. Holy shit, there's a third Mario brother?
Yeah.
Wait.
His name's Scario.
Wait, Scario? Scario? Didn't he sign the Declaration of Independence? We need to steal the Declaration of Independence.
We have to steal that map. The map's on the back of the Declaration of Independence. You can buy it for $5.99 at the gift shop. Wouldn't it be really funny if the copies, the, like, gift shop Declaration of Independence prints also just had the stuff on the back? Like, it's a faithful recreation.
That would be really good. Yeah, well, if you know, they just photocopied both sides, and so...
Yeah.
Naturally, it'd have the secret stuff on the back.
Mm-hmm. The secret sauce. It was like lemon juice or something.
Shout out to my favorite Mario brother, Sicario. Great movie. Didn't know what was happening. 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
So.
Speaking of didn't know what was happening, this episode. So,
oh, boy.
We have the little trailer blazes, but there was one topic that we kind of wanted to focus on this episode.
Yeah, one real unifying factor here. So this might come as a shock for viewers at home, but Wii Game. You could say that we are gaming people.
True.
And one of those games that kind of bit us both on the ass, I think Matthew Marissa first and then myself second.
Well,
I mean, I guess I kind of got you into it, but then you got really into it, and yeah. So I got really into it.
Yeah. It was a mutual sort of a mutual interest.
Yeah. A mutual ass biting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Civilization VI.
Yes, Civ VI. The game.
Sid Meier. It took him 6 tries, but he got it right. It's a really good game.
Yeah. So just sort of some backstory. I played a little bit of Civ 5, but only a little bit, and it was a long time ago, like before the first expansion for it came out, and I hadn't really played Civ since then. And it was like the start of this year, we played one game of Civ 6 with our friends online, and that was the first time I had played Civ 6, and immediately I was like, damn, I want to play this more. And so that's been taking up a significant chunk of time recently.
Yeah, I have sunk no small amount of hours into Civilization 5. My playtime is apparently 114 hours, almost 115.
That's no small amount.
That is no small amount for me specifically. There are people on the Civilization subreddit who are like laughing in my face right now. I can feel them on me. One of them might actually kick down my door before this episode is over in my face.
Bro, he's right behind you.
Oh no. He's right behind me, isn't he? Sorry. Civilization VI has matched that by 127 hours. Succeeded it, even. And it's, I think, just generally a better game than Civ 5. I can provide more perspective on that. But we'll get into the discussion of that real quick, because that's what the episode's about.
Yeah. I wanted to say that, like, so I'm not the best player of Civ 6. I do struggle in deity games, but mainly against the AI declaring surprise wars on me constantly. I don't know what same. I do wrong.
Same, 100%.
They just, I'll just like found my second city or my third city, and they'll be like, I hate you. And I'll be like, I just paid you like 50 gold. What do you mean you hate me? But they hate me.
I want war, and I'm like, I don't have war for you.
It often feels like the civs and deity get a head start ahead of the player.
They do. So one of the things about deity is that to make the AI more threatening, not only do they like rebalance the attitude values slightly. They make them more war happy, basically. But they also literally give them an additional, like, I want to say by deity they get an additional like 3 warriors and like 2 settlers. It might be only 1 settler, but like they get an insane bonus just for being on deity difficulty on top of the more aggression already and just playing better.
Yeah. So when I think a lot of our conversation is going to be in the framework of Civ 6 is a great game, but it could be better. And with like the recent sort of hints towards Civ 7, I think the be better is sort of on our minds, in a lot of people's minds. And I just want to go start by saying that, like, I genuinely don't find deity as fun as it could be because the AI cheat, more or less. I mean, a lot of good players make do with that and they're able to like consistently get victories through deity, but like it just feels bad when like the higher difficulties are just like you get to cheat resources versus this makes more optimal decisions or, you know, is tougher in certain diplomatic ways.
Yeah.
They have better micro. It's they also have 3 cities and 5 warriors by the time you get your first slinger.
Yeah. So I, on one hand, I understand why DD is unfair. I understand why it is sort of essentially a gigantic challenge, which is that in my mind, it's sort of like the core audience is people who have been playing Civ, you know, since like Civ 4 at the very least. Like, it's people who have been playing it so much that, like, in a fair challenge, they would easily take it. There are people who, in any, you know, fair challenge of, or, like, the already unfair challenges of Deity, they already take it pretty easily. But I do think that it should, at the very least, be a toggle for, like, fair and unfair difficulty. There should be a toggle that's like, hey, I want the Deity AIs, but I don't want them to start with 100 different settlers.
Yeah, exactly.
Turn one, like there should be more configuration options out of the box. Is my first point. Also, I do want to briefly lay a little bit of groundwork, just in case you don't play Civ. The best way to describe Civ is it is a 4X strategy game, but if those words don't mean anything to you, it is a board game that is a little too complicated to play as an actual board game.
Let me the who you are, what you do, how you win.
Yes.
That's the easiest way to describe board games, and so I'm going to use that to describe a board game video game. So
hey,
everybody plays.
Who are you?
Yeah, everybody plays as the leader of a civilization, like a historic civilization. And these leaders are famous leaders from history. So, like, Alexander the Great, Dido of Carthage, you know, Cleopatra, Julius Caesar, Abraham Lincoln, Kublai Khan, Tokugawa. It's famous historical leaders playing as their country. And you start from generally the Stone Age. And you sort of progress through eras, through time, by founding and settling cities, advancing your culture of your civilization, which allows you to do things like create art and new governments and do more diplomacy. You can research new technologies, such as things like bronze, farming, animal husbandry, the internet, and more.
All things that we've talked about on this podcast.
Exactly. We've definitely talked about animal husbandry and farming.
And bronze working. I can't believe that hot take that you had about mixed metals, you know, in the bronze working episode where you were like, I think that we shouldn't mix iron and whatever to make steel. And the whole steel community was down our throats. We were practically canceled by the steel community.
Have we talked about Aya Nasir on this podcast? Because that would be kind of bronze working.
You know what? We haven't, and that would make a good state of the meme.
So, the 4X in 4X is expand, explore, exploit, and exterminate. This means you expand your city, your civilization. You explore the world, which initially starts as just sort of a small area that's revealed to you. You slowly map out the land, finding different tribes, different city-states, barbarians, and eventually other players. You exploit the terrain and the resources, which, you know, there's different terrain types, different resources on those terrains, tons of stuff you can do with it. And then the exterminate comes in an emphasis on combat, where you either fight those barbarians, you can fight the computer-controlled city-states, or you can fight other players.
Yes.
Cities have a lot of these interlocking mechanics between, like, food and production and happiness and population.
There aren't 5 unique, like, resources, but there are 5 main victory conditions that have their own specific sort of way to play the game. And so Just starting at the top, we have religion. You can found a religion in the game. If you found a religion, then you are available to do the religion victory, where you try to spread your religion to a majority of civilizations, such that it is, like, literally the majority in every single civilization, and you win through, you know, religious unity.
The next one is domination. Kill everyone. Conquer their cities.
Specifically their capitals, but of their other cities is also probably good to conquer as well.
Sure.
Culture. Hey, you know how, like, everybody was obsessed with Japan in the mid-2000s? That's the culture victory. You're trying to get a high culture, which you then essentially convert into tourism, which is other people's interest in your culture. And then by the end game, you create rock bands to bomb people with tourism to win.
It's more like a hybrid of McDonald's, Hollywood, and the Beatles.
Yeah. That's a euphemism that we use a lot on this podcast, but It's really true here.
Science, which is complete several space exploration projects to eventually colonize Mars.
It's interesting in that it's really mostly passive generation. It's a lot of building and just acquiring science. Finally, diplomacy. You're not going to win this way.
Actually, it's pretty easy to do if you are playing only with computers.
You know, that's true. So diplomacy is, once you meet a sufficient number of people, you start having world congresses where you vote on different policies to enact. If you have voted for the correct policies, you get diplomatic victory points. And sometimes there are also, like, wonders and just policies that give people diplomatic victory points as well. And so if you ultimately acquire, I think, 20, you win. It's more of a, realistically, it's more of a time-based thing that isn't the actual time-based victory condition, which is if you play with that mode. If you play with a score victory, there is a literal set limit of turns, like 500 for standard, 300 or something for quick, etc. And the diplomacy is kind of just a way to, at least in our mind, it's kind of just a way to end the game that isn't score victory.
Yeah. Now, it is worth noting that, like, the reason I say you can kind of go for it if you're playing with AI, specifically the way it works is that whenever these, like, options come up in the World Congress, there's a bunch of different options available in, like, a drop-down menu, and whichever one gets the most votes is enacted. Everybody has a variable number of votes, but you always get to vote on everything once for free. After that, it costs different resources. If you vote for what ends up being the majority, then you get a diplomatic victory point. So, like, you can start to follow the patterns that AI will use in terms of voting. Like,
yeah,
when it's early game and it's, like, plus production in districts of this type, they usually go for city center. So you can kind of go for it, but not really. And we'll explain why, I think, a bit later as we go more into some of the strategies of the game. Sort of the leaders, especially.
Yeah.
I don't know how much we really need to get into, like, the nitty-gritty mechanics. Like, I don't think we really have to go into, like, how to choose which units or which civilians are working which tiles. Or
yeah.
Things like that. I think from this point on, we're going to assume mostly a familiarity.
Yeah. If you are unfamiliar, the general rule of thumb is just sort of everything has a sort of cost in and of itself, but it also gives some kind of benefits. So, for example, culture and science and faith are the main currencies of the culture, science, and religion victories themselves. Culture and science have trackers that unlock specific technologies or, you know, like, cultural unlocks, basically. And so, you know, you can see how gearing towards one thing rather than another ultimately flows into a type of play. So if I'm a civilization that gets really good benefits towards, you know, actually dedicating towards culture, then I'm probably going to spend my early game trying to build towards a, you know, a district that will allow me to build things that, you know, give me more culture and give me great people in culture and what have you.
Yeah. It's you're generally taking, like, your leader in your civ, the, like, actual civilization they represent, and you're looking at, like, what resources does it give you? Does it give you an advantage over other players in, like, a given interaction? Or does it just give you good resources that you can convert into other things?
Yes.
We actually, so I want to talk about sort of the different leaders, but I do want to just start with what our favorite leaders to play are.
Yes.
I think that's kind of fun, kind of a fun start.
Yeah, I very much like that idea. Would you like to start with your favorites?
So I really like Aminator of Nubia. Her game plan is sort of very district heavy, but in, I think, a really thrilling and fun way to optimize, because her unique building, it gains like extra resources or extra production of different resources from being adjacent to different districts. And so like planning out cities with her often ends up like alternating pyramid district, pyramid district, but it also just leads to a very flexible play style where you could be like, oh, there's not a lot of other science civs, so I can build a campus next to the pyramid, or I can build a theater square next to the pyramid and get more bonuses off it. So Nubia's really cool.
Yeah. Nubia is really, really fun, especially because they are a civilization that starts with a unique archer, which is the first step up from Slinger, and is, like, game-defining in the early game. And so the fact that they already start with, like, a better version of an already game-defining unit is, like, so good that, like, it, like, single-handedly solves a lot of your early game woes. And then from there, you can kind of start, you know, playing solitaire a bit, and like you said, planning out just like, okay, I want a city here, I want this district, this pyramid, this district, and, you know, it's one of the civs that feels like it can get away with making those kind of long-term plans very early.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I am a huge fan of the Mali civilization. I would say Mansa Musa, like, to start, but Sundi Adakita probably has usurped him. So Mali's whole deal is that they have significantly less production, like -30% across the board. Just pure producing units and buildings and such is much harder for them, but they have a bunch of bonuses towards gold. Gold is a generally useful resource because it is essentially a like extra production source. 4 gold, I think, is technically equal to 1 production. But what this means as well is that with gold, when you produce it, if you, say, buy a unit or buy a building, you just get it instantly. And so it allows for a certain flexibility where you get a whole bunch of gold, you can, you know, if somebody declares war on you, you can instantly raise an army. You know, if somebody isn't declaring war on you, then you have all this gold to fund into things like, you know, buildings for your cities and stuff. It's such a fun play style as well, because the idea of being just like the center of gold is very fun.
Mm-hmm.
You are susceptible to spies, but you know what? If you aren't having a couple spies in your districts, then that's on you, I suppose.
Yeah. In sort of the inverse way, I really like Wu Zeshan, who is a very aggressive spy-focused leader.
Yeah.
Spies are this weird mechanic that feels like it only comes into play like 30% of the games I play. It's like,
yeah,
you either steal things from other players or you stop them from stealing for you. And this only sometimes matters, and it mainly matters when you either A, need a specific great work, or B, have a lot of money. Because one of the spy's functions is stealing money from other players. So yeah. Wu Zeshan gets spies early, and she also gets culture and science whenever a spy completes a mission. So you are able to just sort of pretty quickly start shooting spies at people's treasuries, stealing a bunch of money from them, and then, you know, just getting bonuses to your other resources from that.
I really like her. My favorite China Civ, however, is Yongle, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yongle.
So I'm fairly certain his name is actually like Yongle.
Yeah.
But it's spelled Yongle, and I get a chuckle every time I see it. He is a tall Civ, so he generally wants a couple of cities, but who have like really big populations.
He's 7 foot and eight.
Yeah, he himself is about 7 feet tall. The history books don't tell you that. 7 foot frame rats along his back. And an ass that don't quit.
Sure.
I can't take credit for that one, though. It's a droppy bit. Anyway, but Yongle, he once a civilization, or once a city reaches 10 population, it gets insane bonuses. Like, every individual citizen starts producing just insane amounts of things. And so, like, he is great for a game where you, like, you know, put out a couple of early cities and then just sort of turtle.
He produces everything. And to make it even better, he has these, like, the ability to spend production on a city on gaining food or faith or, I want to say, gold.
Yes. Yeah.
So
he can turn half production into food or faith, and then full production into gold.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's insane. He is fucking whack. I don't know why they put him out. He's broken.
Well, have you seen Ludwig II?
I mean, yeah, I guess.
they've just so this is I think one of the topics that a lot of people feel regarding the game is that some of the DLC leaders are ridiculous. Yeah. Ridiculously overtuned. I mean, it's not to say there weren't anybody in the base game that was pretty overtuned, like Hammurabi.
Yeah,
who would just get technology all over the place.
Yeah, Babylon. Babylon is the probably biggest example of just the most sort of abjectly broken one. Babylon, I believe, was a DLC unto himself.
Mm-hmm.
Babylon is minus 50% culture or science per turn. So every two science you produce is actually one science. But if you do Eurekas, which are specific to this game, they're kind of like little milestones that if you complete them, you get, you know, a bonus to science. So it gives you things that you can be proactive about with science and culture. Hammurabi's ability is if you do that, instead of getting like 40% towards it, you just get that technology. That's insane.
Yeah,
they have people have tried to rebalance him multiple times to keep some kind of semblance of that ability, and they literally cannot. That is too good of an ability.
Yeah, it skips so much. A lot of like the other people that get big boosts to science or culture just do so with like a big number. Like, yeah. They recently made Sejong, who gets culture equal to his science production when he finishes the first technology of a new era, which ends up being a lot of culture, but, like, only in a single, like, shot. Same with Wu Zeshan.
Yeah. China's base ability is that it adds, in addition to a couple other things, it adds 10% to that total that you get for Eurekas and Inspiration. So mm-hmm. instead of completing 40%, you complete 50%. And that's a really decent bonus. That is like a good couple of turns, especially on higher difficulties.
Yeah. I also like Scotland just because he builds a golf course.
Yeah. Scotland is really interesting to me because he's kind of like, he's kind of a domination civ, but he's also like at his core more of like a sciencey civ.
Yeah.
Which like is really interesting.
His leader ability looks like a domination ability, but you read the rest of his text, like Scotland itself and the text of the golf course, and it's like this is like culture, science, sort of other things.
Yeah, it's weirdly fun. Can we talk about our, not our least favorite, but maybe our, like, biggest disappointments?
I just wanted to say one more thing, which is that Pachacuti is also cool because he cares about mountains, which pretty much no other Civ does.
Yes.
Except maybe one of the Teddy Roosevelts.
Bull Moose Teddy does, kind of. Yeah. Bull Moose does care about mountains to some extent, but, like, mountains are usually still just kind of a dead resource.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, anything that makes use of them is really nice.
Okay, yeah. So, disappointments and other disapprovals.
Yeah. I'm going to start by maybe not showing my hand, but just talking about one specific leader who I always want to work and just kind of isn't great, which is Eleanor. Eleanor is a cross-culture leader. She's a leader for the English and the French. Already banger picks.
The French.
But she is really interesting because I believe great works that she has have, like, a bunch of different extra bonuses, and notably, they cause disloyalty. So loyalty is a mechanic that they added to kind of... It is a newer mechanic that they added, I believe, in one of the DLCs that, essentially is meant to curtail, like, a full domination steamroll. Because you can't just get a bunch of cities and then immediately keep them. You have to keep them loyal, or otherwise they completely rebel and, you know, become a free city and the other civilizations can just try and snatch them away from you. It is a balancing prospect that makes a lot of sense when viewed through that lens. But one of the things you can theoretically do is intentionally cause disloyalty in a city so that it flips to you. That's a cool idea. What's the problem? Well, loyalty is influenced by a million different things. Usually the biggest one is just being close to your other cities. If you're close to your other cities and your capital and stuff, then things will generally stay loyal. And when it comes to intentionally causing disloyalty, there's not a lot of things you can do. There's like three different things. There's like a spy action, a secret society unit, and like just straight up Eleanor's ability, basically. And that's kind of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's kind of it in terms of things you can actively do to try and sow dissent. And that's, it doesn't need to be a foreground ability, but it does suck that if you want to actually play with this kind of ability, you are literally pigeonholed into just, like, one of three things you can do.
Yeah, and it's also at such a bad rate that, like, you can't really flip a city unless it would already be flipped eventually. Like,
yeah,
I've tried to do that with Wu Zeishan spies, but the amount of loyalty a city loses per turn or per mission just doesn't feel like enough unless it's already, you know, not loyal to begin with that much.
Yeah.
I think loyalty as a mechanic, it kind of puts a, it kind of prevents you from doing, like, super far expansion, which is kind of unfortunate because I wish it was really possible to, like, settle on a little island or on a different continent and still keep the city. As it kind of is, it feels like if you settle away, like, across the ocean from your other cities, you just are going to lose your new city in a few turns.
Yeah.
Or it's, you have, like, to work super hard and, you know, spend a bunch of resources on it.
Yeah. It's like, I understand it's a, you know, curtailing measure to some extent. There are individual civs that give specific bonuses that allow them to create these kinds of cities, especially like the English or the Spanish, I believe.
People known for doing that sort of thing. Australia.
Basically. Yeah, yeah. That's one thing with Civ. I can't get upset about it, really. Like, even your as a leftist, like, I it's something where it's, I don't want to say it's, you know, not being examined or challenged or anything. Like, it's, you know, it's history. Realistically, a lot of history sucks. But, like, Also, like, Abraham Lincoln, his ability is called the Emancipation Proclamation, which gives you loyalty for industrial zones and loses loyalty for plantations. And I'm like, that's like that sounds like a joke somebody would make. that he loses loyalty for plantation because, you know, it's Abe Lincoln and slavery. But like, it's one of those things where it's actually in the game and I'm like, I don't know if this is acceptable. Like, it's, and again, like, so many of these is also just things where, like, you know, the Mongol Empire is in it, the Khans are in it, like, there's a bunch of different civilizations, and it is cool to represent them in fun and interesting ways. And so, you know, like, while a lot of these leaders, if I go to their Wikipedia entry, probably did some terrible shit, like, can I really get complete, can I get upset with civilization that they are just sort of like, yeah, you know, if these guys existed and here's their unique ability, which is kind of how they were.
I mean, that's sort of like games about historical civilizations. They tend to end up like that.
Yeah.
And I feel like Civ has this air of abstraction to it that makes it feel different than something like, I don't know, World of Tanks.
Like, yeah.
Like, Civ is a game that it's very cartoony in terms of its art style. It feels so disconnected from actual real life events in terms of, like, the way the pieces work, the way you view the board. It like you said, it feels more like a board game. And to me, there's a level of separation there that keeps me from thinking about, like, the implications of that, unless there is, like, playing as America and now you're attacking Mexico or something.
Yeah.
but like,
there's little bits where it like realigns, but like you said, it seems generally abstract enough.
Mm-hmm. And for every moment of, like, Abe Lincoln destroying, you know, the Native Americans, you can also play as the Native Americans and destroy Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
You play as the Cree and fuck up all the conquistadors. Yeah. And all the settlers and colonialists.
I would liken it to, like, Crusader Kings 3, for example, took out the line Days of Old because it was, you know, in Crusader Kings 2. And, like, at the time, that was just kind of, you know, it's like, yeah, for the glory of the homeland or whatever. It's, you know, it's a storytelling machine about the Middle Ages. But then, you know, we had sort of like a lot of people who were really obsessed with certain periods of history turned out to be Nazis, weirdly. And so the developers were just sort of like, hey, look, you know, this is still a game about the Middle Ages and stuff, but, like, we're going to take out Deus Vult because we don't want to be associated with these people. And it's like, and that's, I think, you know, an example where it did actually matter and they did do the right thing to not kind of glorify it. This is, like you said, just such a cartoony thing where it's like, ah, God, the Mongols are invading Japan. The Mongols are invading Japan. Oh, no. But I almost finished the Eiffel Tower here in Switzerland.
Yeah,
how will this affect my suzerainty of fucking Cahokia?
Yeah,
it's like aliens playing with Earth pieces.
A lot of the, like, games that tend to attract Nazis and fascists are very specifically tied to a specific time and place and era. You know, like games with, like, World War II simulations or Mordhau and military or medieval games where you play as knights. But like, Civ is so far removed from those. It is not about a specific time or place at all. It's timeless and placeless. So I think that helps it.
Yeah.
Now we'll ignore the mods because mods are where hell goes. Except the mod actually, that adds FGO great people and the mod that adds the Haruhi religion icon.
Yes. The only two good mods.
I want to quickly go over something, which is we've noticed that as the expansions have come out, the new leaders, it feels like there are some strategies that are overrepresented compared to others.
Why, that sounds like a segue to a thing that I put together and had you help with.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we had the sneaking suspicion because a lot of the leader passes that have come out have seemed to be more focused on culture specifically.
Mm-hmm.
It's always kind of seemed like culture was a little overrepresented, but it wasn't too bad. And, you know, it wasn't necessarily too bad. And then we got new leader pass after new leader pass as they're kind of seemingly wrapping things up on Civ 6. And it seemed like culture overload. Like there were kind of, you know, a couple things that did things with science and then a couple things that did things with domination, but it was mostly just culture after culture after culture. And so I got curious and I made a spreadsheet.
In this spreadsheet, we listed out every civ, every civilization, and then every leader for every civilization. And we marked down the five main victory conditions. And then we also created a column for non-victory related bonuses. So yes. These are things that go towards like production and food and gold. And we listed out every sort of benefit that those civs and leaders give to those categories.
Yes. Before talking about the results, I do want to talk about what this list doesn't have, which is that realistically, I wanted just sort of like a heavy air quotes objective, as objective as it really could be, but a heavy air quotes objective view on just the literal statistical advantages, specifically geared towards the five main victory conditions. When you mentioned the like multi-purpose column, that is like anything from food to production to like plus 25% towards building districts to plus 15% building wonders. Like that is things that are game defining, but are not 100% towards this.
They usually can be put towards other victory conditions. They're feeders.
Exactly. This, like, if I really wanted to like 100% analyze all of it, I would have like specific ones for, you know, like production or food. I would have like all of the individual leaders with the individual civilizations, because a specific leader can change how you play a civilization drastically. But this was meant to be just a quick and dirty sort of like, here is the literal statistical advantages that all of these have to see if what we think is overrepresented is actually overrepresented.
Yes.
And with that said, far as the civilizations are concerned, multi-purpose things is by and large the leader. That makes a lot of sense. It at like 31 out of, I want to say there's like 50 something total.
50.
Ah, just 50. But it is interesting that ultimately religion and science are pretty equal. 8 specifically towards religion, 7 specifically towards science. Diplomacy is hilarious.
It's a
there
joke.
Are three. Yeah. There are three civilizations that get diplomacy bonuses. And then domination and culture are tied for 11.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not... Honestly, I would say that that is not a terrible distribution if it was just that. That, you know, makes a good amount of sense to me. Domination and culture are the generally most active victory conditions, because domination involves you having to manage an entire army to conquer area. And then culture is, culture has a lot of different moving parts, and it always kind of unlocks a new moving part as you get later into the game. Science being slightly lower than religion, it's essentially on par. Those both also kind of make sense. Religion is beyond diplomacy, it is the second most tacked on victory condition, I would say. It's very insular.
So religion is weird. It feels very similar to domination because religion is very micro heavy, very unit heavy. And it also ends up having a lot of combat because there is a separate form of religious combat where religious units fight each other. And so I don't think it's tacked on necessarily. It's weird because it doesn't I would say like military can fight against culture and science. Science can be used to unlock new warriors to help you defend yourself against military. Culture can get you production bonuses to put towards other things. But like religion, it goes outward, but there's not many things that affect religion other than religion.
Yeah, it's annoying because like once you unlock temple, that's basically it. Like once you have unlocked the second tier worship building, that's all you really get for religion. There are a couple of wonders that deal with it, but like barring maybe one, which is like
Christ the Redeemer.
Yes. Yeah. Like maybe Christ the Redeemer. Oh wait, no, that's a culture one.
Yeah.
Sorry. What am I thinking of? Is it Mount St. Michael? Possibly. Yeah. Point being, there is not a lot of actual religious play once you get that done. This also kind of means that it's one of the victory conditions that you really can't do if you're playing against other humans. Because, like, any human that could see this going on can immediately start reinvesting in their religion to make sure that you wall them. And because it is, like, insular to itself, that won't entirely that might cost them faith, which is a very powerful currency. But they still have their production, their gold, their, military, they're everything else that they're doing. And so if they're going for another victory condition, they can just sort of wall you out and then keep going for their victory condition. Meanwhile, you're, specifically dedicating yourself to religion and getting walled because of it.
Yeah, it's easy to wall religion. The other thing is that, so religion requires great prophets, of which there are a limited number of. And there are fewer great prophets than there are number of players. So not everyone will get a religion. And if you're playing on Deity, where the AI cheats, it'll be very easy for them to get prophets before you do.
Yeah.
So I've had so many games where I'm like, I would like to have a religion, so I could either be offensive with it or defensive, but I just can't because I've missed my chance to get great prophets. Because I don't even have the ability to construct temples or religious districts.
It's annoying because it is such a boon that you want it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very difficult to, especially on Deity, get it. And then even once you do get it, like, it's really just a bonus towards a pre-existing like victory condition.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I can use this to generate more culture for me, or I can use this to generate more growth for me. You rarely use religion for religion.
Mm-hmm. So going down to the individual leaders now,
yes.
I think this is a very interesting distribution. So multipurpose is still pretty high with 34. Still, again, makes sense. It's just a good thing to put into, and that also combines production, money, and food, so, Religion and science are still close with 11 and 12, 12 religion and 11 science. So science is still lower than religion by one, but they're still fairly low.
Yeah.
Then
diplomacy is even more hilarious.
Still a joke. And then domination is 22 and culture is 24. We're kind of right in that there's more culture than everything else, but especially compared to religion and science.
Yeah, I also even want to specifically mention that, like, domination, a number of the ones that were ticked for domination are things that in a real game you would not use for actual domination, but more deterrence.
Yeah, a lot of it is things like Gilgamesh that care more about defending territory or like helping allies.
Yeah. Yeah. John Curtin gets bonuses after like declarations of war, but specifically declarations of war against him.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's a very good deterrent thing.
Or I want to say there's one of them that like gets extra like attack when liberating or when doing a war of liberation, but like
that's Curtin.
Oh, that is?
Yeah, yeah. After liberating a city, he gets plus 100% production.
Yeah. So yeah, the things we marked as domination, you're not necessarily going to win with for military. It's more so that the only thing they give you is extra military in some way.
Yeah. Whereas with culture, I'm sure that there are cases where you can essentially use the culture to bolster another victory condition. But more often than not, if you are in culture, it behooves you to keep going into culture.
Yeah.
Like, you know, even science is kind of like it. Science sort of helps domination victory in that you can unlock later units earlier. And, you know, it does help other victories as well. Religion generally kind of helps other victories if you tailor it for that. Culture does help other victories, but, like, there's so many bonuses that essentially kind of really want you to go into culture that it feels overrepresented. Like, and it is kind of statistically overrepresented in this view, which is still flawed.
So, with culture, I want to give a little bit of sort of, a bit of a dive into that. So, culture builds into everything else for a few reasons. The main one, though, is government.
Yes.
So, different governments, the way this works is you have a government itself, which is sort of like, you know, theocracy, monarchy, democracy, communism. And these give you a bonus off the bat to something, and they eventually will give negatives to other things that you're not doing, so that kind of later governments are specialized.
Yeah.
Then they have what are called policy cards, which are little passives that you get throughout the game. So you unlock policy cards through culture. There are four different types. There's military, economic, political, and wild card. Military usually involves military, the production of military units, military buildings, or sometimes other civil engineering like walls and roads. Economic is, it kind of deals with every district. It gives you more money, obviously, through different ways, but it also increases bonuses from theater squares and campuses and holy sites. They're like the econ in the sense of like gamer econ, like it's for your engine. Diplomacy usually is involved with city states, just kind of in general, or with your own governors.
Yeah.
Which,
diplomacy is either like a loyalty thing or it is, like you said, the city states.
Yeah. And then wild card can hold any card. But also there are specific purple cards that usually give you great person points.
Yeah.
And
later into the game, a lot of wild cards will also do things like giving you more housing in your empire or, you know, more doing more things with governors and such.
Yeah.
But so, especially early game, you're usually going to be using it for great persons.
Yeah. So like you don't even start with a wild card slot. So if you want a better chance at getting great people, you have to get a lot of culture so you can get political philosophy, which is the boost that you research through the culture tree that lets you get your first governments.
Yes.
And then
now.
Oh,
I will come to their defense and just say that the opening from the opening immediately to political philosophy is kind of essentially just baseline what you want to do. Like that's usually what you're going to do in every game anyway. It does. And like there are specific civs that like start with different policy slots, you know, and things like that. But for the vast majority of civs, getting that first real government is like the first thing you do culture-wise completely. Yeah.
And then, like, as you progress through more governments, you get more culture card slots, more government policy cards. You get more card slots, and they're all good because they just provide passive benefits to you. But also there are diplomatic points and envoy points. And so diplomatic points are the things you use to vote. The amount of diplomatic points it takes to buy a vote increases per vote already on a point in the World Congress. So, yeah. Like, it's free, and then it's 10, and then it's 20, and so forth. And with enough diplomatic points, you can more or less force a result to be favorable for you. And also, that's how you can get diplomatic victory points more consistently. So in a way, culture builds into diplomatic points.
Yes.
But also, the envoy system is you gain a number of points towards an envoy every turn, and once it fills up, you get an envoy as a like resource you can spend. And you assign these to city-states, and if you have one envoy, three envoys, or six envoys in a given city-state, you get boosts to a type of resource depending on what color or what type the city-state is. So you can get boosts to military production, culture, science, religion, money. But then every city-state has a unique ability for if you are the suzerain. And you are the suzerain if you have the most envoys in a civilization, I believe by two or more. Maybe just one.
It's just by one or more, but it starts at three.
Yeah.
You have to, yeah, it's like, it. The minimum is three, and then after that you have to be the highest among everybody else.
Yeah. So being a suzerain gives you a ton of benefits because it gives you the bonus resources, it gives you whatever bonus the suzerain T bonuses, which could be really big for some things. Sometimes it's just you can build something cool like a Cahokia mound.
Yeah, shout out to Cahokia.
Other times it's like pretty game-breaking stuff. Also, they will fight with you and defend you and fight against your enemies. It's
you can levy them if you don't have much of your own military. Like it's really good benefits.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be the suzerain quite badly of a number of different ones.
So like, while like religion kind of boosts other things and science kind of boosts other things, but science you still have to filter through production, culture just ends up leading to huge benefits. And that's not even counting things like feudalism or guilds that just passively boost your stuff.
Yeah.
I think culture is very strong in Civ 6. And especially the fact that when you unlock things from culture, you don't often have to produce them outside of like a few new districts like, Diplomatic Quarter or Circus Entertainment Plaza.
Yeah.
Also, culture unlocks the neighborhoods, which are just super useful late game. So yeah, culture is just kind of really strong. And so it often feels like not having solid culture gain is detrimental.
Yeah. It's...
So here's sort of one of my problems is that I love the idea of the science victory, but it feels like you can't really do that easily. Or like, not even easily, but as easy as the other ones.
Yeah, it's... I want to say that I will be speaking in cursed name here, but I want to say that Civ Beyond Earth had a similar situation. I have not played this. I've heard about it through word of mouth, where essentially one victory condition was so easy and or just kind of like so beneficial that going for literally any other one meant you would lose the game.
Yeah.
This is not as bad. Not nearly as bad. As bad. But it is still a situation where, like, you kind of have that little voice when you're playing a different victory that just says, like, But, you know, like, you also have these cool bonuses towards culture. You could just go for a culture victory. And it's like, but I want to do other things.
So, like, with science, like, the thing about science victories is that, for one thing, pretty much everything still needs to go through production. So, whereas culture largely works with just getting culture, science, you at least need two different resources.
Yeah.
And that's not counting the fact that you need, like, improvements built, production's kind of hard to get early game, you need, like, multiple cities to some extent with them. And science also just takes forever.
Yeah.
I feel like that's...
Science...
Yeah.
Science is mostly passive generation, and that's generally, like, in a vacuum, that's fine. But like you said, science also, like, the passive generation takes a very long time, and it, you know, you're usually spinning a lot of other plates too, and so, like, it feels just kind of like it feels like you're doing nothing, but at the same time, you can't just tune it out, because usually you're also like, well, I don't want to, you know, get into war with my neighbors, and I, you know, need to keep my people happy, so I'm going to be doing all this. And, like, that's, you know, that's part of an engaging game, but if none of it is, you know, really helping towards your science victory until, like, the last, you know, third of the game, then, like, it feels a little raw, especially when things like culture, you know, have a lot of presence outside of, you know, throughout the entire game.
Yeah. So we're taking quite a while. I kind of want to jump to the sort of fixes or concepts for Civ 7.
Yes.
Because, so we've talked a lot about sort of our general problems with the game. I want to bring up a few things we had talked about on our own time as, like, maybe not necessarily the best ideas. You know, ideas are a dime a dozen, but sort of things that could be interesting. Any modders out there, if you're interested, free to use. I don't know. So I want to preface this by saying, while I have game design experience, I am not a designer for Civilization. So this is all from the perspective of a fan slash enthusiast.
While I have some game design experience, I do not have a lot. And so this is, I'm going to say that this is mandatory. If they don't do this in Civ 7, I will be boycotting the game. Catch me in my boycott Steam group, where you can catch me playing Civ 7 on day of release.
So one sort of point that I think could be improved is the way area control works. Because while I get the idea behind the loyalty mechanic, it also often feels like it punishes you for trying to make territory grabs early on, which means that, like, you can't be as proactive about, like, establishing a border, you know? If somebody else settles a city near you, and you only have, like, one warrior or two warriors there, your warriors are just gonna get kicked out when they settle the city. And so, like, I think one proposition is to make a smaller alternative to the city, maybe one that can't grow its borders, and maybe is just a little worse stat-wise, but is easier to produce and less reliant on proximity to other cities. This is my proposition for the hamlet.
Yes.
Just imagine, like, it only has the six cells around it, and then itself as the territory. It has a limit to the population it can have, and it has a pretty small limit on what all it can build, like maybe just two districts if they keep districts. But like, I think, like, the ability to, like I said, control territory, contest a resource that's not immediately adjacent to your starting position but you might want, or set up a border, or, like, if there is an area that you could view as a choke point, trying to set it up for defensive purposes, while still having the loyalty mechanic for the big cities, would be cool.
Yeah. It's I like it a lot because I like it a lot as an idea because it also feels like something that gets not a lot of love in base game Civ 6, which is the fort, which is like a theoretically decent. It's a theoretically decent defensive tile that you place down and has its own health and its own armor, like its own walls, essentially. And it does like a bit of a culture bomb around an area, and it also unlocks its own buildings. And that sounds all cool, but by the end of it, you kind of just have a dead tile.
Mm-hmm.
You have a tile that isn't producing you anything, is, you know, completely useless to you. And like, you know, most of the benefits are just gaining XP for your units, which if you're a domination player, you're probably already gaining XP for your units. So it's a purely defensive district that you really only want to play defensively with. And like, it feels like if you reworked that into something like the Hamlet, into something where it's area control that is, you know, less useful, but still useful, you know, just like little spot control. Like that seems that is a way of repurposing something that a lot of players don't use into something that theoretically seems like a lot of players might get more use out of.
Mm-hmm.
My big sort of like, hey, game designers do this is migration. I think that I like I genuinely kind of like the housing system. I will say I don't like leader abilities that screw with the housing system, but I think the baseline housing system as a way of kind of like encouraging certain types of build is a decent system. And it makes a lot of sense with, you know, it makes a lot of intuitive sense. I think that instead of the punishment being that you don't produce citizens, essentially, you should keep producing citizens that go to your enemy's territory. This is sort of a proposal of a mechanic that would like have to be baked into the core. And I don't expect this to be a thing that would actually be made without having to make some kind of 4X game myself. But I think that would add sort of a layer of strategy to, like, it would be an interesting way to kind of curtail wide builds, kind of help tall builds, but also kind of punish tall builds as well if they, you know, if they lose track of this. Like, I think it would be something that would be thematically resonant, which, you know, Civ kind of like more and more keeps wanting to be thematically resonant with the times. In the most recent, like in the last biggest expansion for Civ 6, they added natural disasters and climate change based. And so, like, I think it would be an interesting addition along those lines of, like, you know, if you lose housing, then people have to start migrating out, you know, that sort of thing, which could then also lead to different things like, you know, well, if people migrate out, then they probably spread their culture. You know, they probably spread the science to an extent as well. And so, you know, it could be helpful for culture civilizations to lose population, but it would also be, you know, harmful for, like, science civs to maybe lose population, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. I think so. One of the topics I've seen discussed a lot, or at least fairly often, is does Civ need another win con?
Yes,
because it feels like right now there's sort of two win cons that are very good, two that are inevitable, they're inevitabilities, and then two that are kind of or very difficult, at least.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I would definitely love to see religion and science, you know, kind of tuned up in line with with culture and domination. I've heard some ideas, like, I like the idea of a, like, currency, an economic victory. One idea I had was a language system, which would work similar to religion, except not, but in that you would found it, and then I don't know what, you know, what bonuses it would give, but it would at least be something where it travels to other civs that you interact with, whether it's through spreading religion or trade routes or such like that, but mainly trade routes and like trade deals. And you would also spread it to city states that you trade with or have suzerainty with. And the ultimate like win con being to have a global language, have a language that is known throughout the world.
Yeah.
And I mainly think like the currency win con idea is just that most of the main districts have a win con associated, but not the market square. Whereas like you, if you think about it, there's the holy site, which gives you religion, theater square that gives you culture, the campus that gives you science, the government plaza and diplomatic quarter give you diplomacy, encampment gives you you know, military, but then like the stuff that gives you gold doesn't really build into its own thing, it just goes into everything else. Whereas yeah, like for every other for the most part, for the other main like districts, you can kind of specialize in them. You can specialize in money, but it really only acts as a facilitator towards other things,
which like in itself isn't terrible, but there are many other industrial zone, for example, is itself a facilitator, usually more towards like a science victory.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's there are a number of facilitators, but it's like you've got the growth facilitator and the aqueduct and the neighborhood, you've got the production facilitator, you know. And so it feels like gold should be more than a facilitator for it being such a standardized thing. For it being a thing that's existed in, like, every Civ game.
Yeah. Also, this sort of views it as trying to find an existing system that doesn't really have a win con for itself versus trying to create a new system with new, like, districts. At least the, yeah, like, idea of an economic victory.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, similarly, I would love to see trade routes expanded. Trade routes, I believe, were introduced in a DLC for Civ 5.
I don't know if they were in a DLC for Civ 5, but they were in Civ 5. They were fucking great in Civ 5, and they are kind of good facilitators in Civ 6.
So,
but they are definitely underpowered, so yeah.
Yeah, traders are interesting because they give you, like, mainly give you money, and they can also give you culture and faith and science. But one of the coolest things is they build roads.
Yes.
Which, like, movement through terrain is this huge thing in Civilization. Every unit that uses the ground has to deal with, like, hills and woods slowing them down, and roads let them circumvent that. You know, they're roads, they do road things. But one problem is that, so the way trade routes work is you start them off in one of your cities, then you select another city or city state to send them to, and then they go. You don't really control them each step, and so what this means is like you're kind of at the whim of the trader as far as where the roads end up. Like, say I wanted to have a trader go from my capital city to China's capital city, but I want it to pass through one of my other cities to create another road there. It's not guaranteed to go through my other city if there is a more direct path to its destination that goes around my other city.
Yeah.
But I would love to have the sort of freedom of more direct control just so I could, you know, better optimize roads. Additionally, trading posts are boring in that they are, once you complete a trade route somewhere, you get a trading post in that location, which gives a gold boost to trade routes that are sent to that location and through that location. But again, yeah, it's really hard to guarantee that a trade route will go through a location to get somewhere else. So if you could, you know, at least set multiple paths or multiple stations on a path, that way you could have it, you know, go to city A, then city B, and then return, so that you stack up trading post benefits. That would be nice.
For a little bit of context, in Civ 5, roads were worker productions. You had to specifically, workers in Civ 5 did not have charges. They were just, you built them and then they could do a job until they could do all their jobs until they were captured. And their jobs also had turn limits. So, like, you know, it was 3 turns to build a workshop or whatever. However, roads were part of this, whereby you had to specifically, essentially, micromanage builders to build a road. And so when Civ 6 came out and that was outsourced to traders, it was, like, a little bit besaddening, but it was also like, oh, thank God, I don't have to micro nearly as hard. Like, I don't have to give nearly as much active sort of, you know, prescience to these specific roads. However, I think that, like you said, they kind of overcorrected in the opposite direction, where now it feels like you have a lot less control.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's somewhere in the midpoint where, like, you don't have to specifically micro, but like you said, just the ability to add specific stops would be so nice.
Additionally, so one of the biggest issues with traders early game is the fact that they can be plundered, which kills the trader, steals money, and makes you sad.
Yeah.
Because you now wasted all that time or money or production on a trader, but it's gone now. And this usually happens from barbarians early game. But, like, if you could further control where the trader goes, you could try to route them such that the route might be slower, but goes away from barbarians. Like, yeah. That would be just so handy. I also would love if trading posts were just a thing you can build for your trader to stop at. Maybe that would be, like, part of the micro is, like, you build a trading post and then you can set multiple stops, which can include cities or trading posts, but I digress.
Yeah. I have one last thing that I would be like, here's what I would want. And it's less of a game defining thing, but I kind of hate eras.
Yeah, that's fair.
I kind of just, I don't like there being a literal turn limit on the things that I, on the benefits. And I don't like that, you know, if you aren't playing towards era score, then you will literally never see any benefit from it. And, like, I understand that it's part of the game, but, you know, that's why I'm saying here's what I want. In Civ 5, they had a happiness system. Where essentially you would, you had happiness, the happiness would tick up or tick down, if you had an amount of luxuries or other various things. But the important thing is that excess happiness would go towards a golden age tracker, and the golden age would then last for, like, you know, 10 turns or whatever, and you would get just quite a few benefits from it. I think that, essentially, but they should... I would personally love it if they retooled the amenities and the amenity system and the, like, era system into kind of like a midpoint, where it's like you get progress towards a golden age, and then once you get the golden age, then you can choose some kind of declaration, and, you know, then you get some kind of customized bonus. Because, like, you know, Golden Age was kind of overpowered in Civ 5. If you were playing well enough, you would just always have a Golden Age and thus always get the bonus yields and everything. So I think that, you know, essentially finding a half measure between the previous system and the current system would be really nice.
Yeah, as it is, it's like, it's legitimately really hard to get a Golden Era if you don't have certain things near your spawn point. Because, yeah. Like, the way it works is you have to complete these achievements to get era score, but those achievements are things like contacting a tribal village, clearing a barbarian camp within 6 tiles of your capital, or maybe it's 10 tiles. It has to be close. And then, like, doing a few things for the first time. But the issue is that, like, if you don't get one early, it's super hard to catch up and get another golden era. Whereas, like, if you do get a golden era early, it usually means you can funnel the bonuses to more golden eras. And then, like, that's not even counting the fact that if you just run out of things you can do to get era score, you enter a dark age and your people hate you and your production's bad and your growth is bad.
Yeah, it's dislike. I don't like the current era system. I want it to be reworked, even if it's not the idea I proposed. I would just like it to be different from how it is in Civ 6.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're getting to the end here.
Yes, I need to,
because this is going on for pretty long. I want to briefly mention things that I like, because this has been a lot of criticism. But, like, I want to also talk about things that I think the game does just really, really well. Like, just, you know, well to the point where I would be like, don't even change it. This is perfect. I'm going to even start that off with governors. Mm-hmm. Governors were not in base game. They were added in the first DLC, I want to say. But they were such a lateral addition that is, incredibly good, that it kind of feels like it's always been there at base game.
They're still kind of imbalanced, but they are still good.
Yeah. There are individual governors that are just better than others, generally speaking. Shoutouts to Pingala for being, like, the just kind of broken.
And Magnus as well for being one of the best to start with.
Yeah, Magnus is the best starting one. Pingala is the one that you slot in once you're in a good situation. But, like, you know, even with that said, like, I also really like going Rhea a couple games because, mm-hmm. you know, especially when I'm doing Molly games, I really like the extra gold generation. Amansi, I believe is her name, is really good at getting an early suzerainty. It is a robust system that can be expanded upon in interesting ways, but is also, like, just at its core, I think, a very good system.
Mm-hmm. Likewise, I think monopolies and secret societies can pretty much stay as they are.
Yes.
I really like games where you can kind of plan out your first few actions. Build order games, I would call them. When I play, like, turn-based strategy games of whatever type, I like being able to have a build order that I improve upon between games. And I think Civ does this really well.
Yeah. So I also think... This might be controversial specifically with you. I honestly think Domination Victory in Civ 6 is probably as good as it's been in any Civ game.
Okay.
And, like, Domination Victory can feel like a slog, but I feel like Civ 6 is probably the best iteration. Like, it is just a little more complicated than the base than Civ 5. But it also, like, adds the fact that, you know, corps and armies are present, like, adds so much to, like, not having to micro every individual thing, you know, or at least having to micro every individual thing a lot less. The you know, the ability to play defensively has been buffed, but the ability to play offensively has kind of equally been buffed. And so I think that Domination as it exists is as, like, the best it has been in a Civ game, and I cannot think of anything I would change with it.
And that takes us to the end of our episode. This is post-production Matthew Marissa here, recording the ending because at the time we recorded the episode, it was really late at night, and I did not have dinner at that time. So, thank you for listening. You can follow us on any podcasting platform you like. Give us a like, give us a rating, give us a comment, give us a review. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know what topics you want to see us cover or topics you think we'd be interested in. You can also follow us on Twitter at NetSurferPro, where we post updates and teasers for upcoming episodes. You can follow me on Twitter at Twakaroo, Twakaroo, where you can see updates on what projects I'm working on, what my thoughts are on various things, usually what kind of games I've been playing, as well as when I go live on my stream at twitch.tv/twack. That's twitch.tv/twak. I stream most weekdays, usually from about 1 p.m. Central Time to 3 or 4 p.m. Central Time. Lately, I've been streaming Super Mario Sunshine, which is my favorite Mario game. And I'll probably be playing Pikmin 2 pretty soon. So, usually though, I stream, like, competitive games, strategy games, roguelites. I also have been playing a lot of Hitman Freelancer mode. So if any of that sounds cool, check that out. You can also follow Galen at GalenWilson0n, Galen Wilson with a W, with a zero, on Twitter. And you can also follow him at Galen Wilson on Tumblr and TikTok. Not sure about the zero. I always forget. He's usually the one that does his part of the intro. I mean, the outro. Or the intro. He does his part of the intro as well. But thanks for listening, and we'll see you later.